You guys ready to get started?
Yeah, let's go for it.
All right. Well, thanks everybody for attending. Those in person here at the beautiful 220 French Landing and Metro Center, and those who are via Teams. I hope you guys can hear us. Troy Haley, administrator of the Bureau, and super happy to see friendly faces in person again. It's been a long time since the EMAC committee met. I think it's been 3 or 4 years probably. So it's good to get back together again. And I guess maybe we should go around the room and just quick intro and say who we are and who we're with. So again, I'm Troy Haley, Bureau Administrator.
Shara Hamlet, Program Coordinator for the Compliance Program.
Barbara Reagan, Auditor for the Compliance Unit.
Michelle Brocious, Compliance Specialist 2.
Taylor Johnson, Compliance Specialist 1.
Carol Duncan, Exemption Register.
Nicolette Sander, Compliance Specialist 1.
Olivia Walker, Exemption Registry.
Amanda Terry, Director of Legal Services, Legislative Liaison.
Claudia Byers, Director of Compliance.
Kevin Hale, representing all of you non-Bureau people. Hale Insurance.
April Nick Bowden, attorney with the Compliance Program.
And I think we've got ID on everybody that's participating via Teams. There's one caller that called in, and it doesn't identify that person. Bob, is that you? No, I guess not.
Whoever ends with the 5200 number?
I think it's Rick.
Okay.
So we also have Elizabeth Cornicelli.
Yes.
Yep. Oh.
I know.
She's like, that's fine. I know.
I think I'm that corner Selly for no reason.
She's just guarding the tree. That's all.
Okay. Corner Selly. Yeah.
But
I got it.
Yeah. Well. She's security.
Well, I appreciate everybody joining and attending, and we'll cut right to the chase. I think Amanda was going to start us off with a legislative update, and then Claudia was going to take it from there.
Yes. Troy missed the key word on our legislative update, which is brief. just to let y'all know kind of what's going on, we do have a workers' comp admin bill, and as of this morning, it is still on the governor's desk waiting for signature, so it's made its way through the process. And that, if you're not familiar with it, it just does some changes, for example, cleaning up some stuff with EDI. It does some cleaning up for the compliance program. It just makes it more clear that penalties can be assessed against a construction or non-construction business. When we changed that, I think it was in 2021, there was potentially some room for ambiguity, and we wanted to make sure that that was cleaned up again. That is on the governor's desk, waiting for signature. It also contains in its sunset for the MPC, the MAC, which are both like medical committees, and then also for our compliance part. So those have all gone well and easy. We also have House Bill 2306, Senate Bill 2909. That is the self-insured pool, and I can repeat that.
Mm-hmm.
Senate Bill 2909, House Bill 2306, and that just creates a nonprofit, unincorporated legal entity that is to be known as Tennessee Self-Insurers Guarantee Association, and that is for the self-insured pool. It was placed on regular House calendar and recommended for passage with amendments on the Senate calendar and committee. That was the update as of today. And then I don't think I gave you the bill numbers for the admin bill, but let me give those to you. Those are, the admin bill is House Bill 1694, and Senate Bill 2094. That's House Bill 1694, Senate Bill 2094. And then lastly, there is a military bill that's coming through. It is House Bill 1887 and Senate Bill 2083. And this just expands the types of duties that qualify a member for the National Guard, State Guard, or Civil Air Patrol, who is also a state employee for employment protection. It specifies a calculation to determine the amount of monetary benefits for a National Guard member who is injured or killed in the line of duty based on the member's average salary. So just wanted to let you all know about that. It was in state government yesterday and referred to the Senate Calendar Committee. So, yes.
Can you send that to me?
I will be glad to send that. Yes.
One thing that's important about the Bureau's administration bill, which is the House Bill 1694, Senate Bill 2094, there's a provision in that that extends the coverage fraud bill from 3 years ago that many of you worked on. It extends it for 5 more years. So that gives Claudia and her team some additional enforcement mechanisms, stress warrants, subpoena power, et cetera. So I think that was really the main focus of our administration bill this year. It passed without any questions or any issues.
All right. Well, I guess that means it's time for me. So I will hop in with, first, I'll just give kind of an update and status of where we are as the compliance program for the Bureau. We are currently, probably for the first time in many, many years, and have been for a little bit now, fully staffed. We have 10 full-time investigators, which is one additional investigator than we had originally had several years ago, the last time that we met. So with that, we have Lakeisha Woodard and Katrina Pearson covering Memphis, West Tennessee area. Longtime investigator Ben Edwards is still in Jackson, holding down the fort with Jackson area and remaining West Tennessee counties. In Middle Tennessee, we have 3 newer investigators since we've had this meeting. We've got Michelle Brocious, Taylor Johnson, and Nicolette Sanders, who are all here. Chattanooga, we have Tay Massey. Veteran investigators Kim Stoner and Rick Day are still in the Knoxville area, and we have finally got someone in Far East Tennessee again. We've got Willie Gott covering the Gray and Bristol area. So we expand the entire state and have really seen an increase in probably the number of cases we're able to handle because of being fully staffed. Our attorneys, we've still got Mark Finks and April Bowden with our team, still going strong, and we have added Nina Harris to our attorney team. Nina came to us from the mediator program, so she's very familiar with workers' compensation cases and has been able to add an additional aspect to the work that we do for really understanding and being able to explain to the employers why they need this and why it's a benefit to them as well as their employees. We've got Barbara Reagan as our auditor, and she helps with all things penalties and helps us have the most accurate penalties that we can. But we wouldn't be able to do any of it without our admin staff. So we've got Shara, Liz, Patricia Thompson, Sue Gordon, and we'll talk about exemption registry in a little bit, but we have Olivia Walker and Carol Duncan who take care of all things exemptions for us, and that is a task. So that we are very thankful for them. As far as misclassification goes, obviously misclassification is still a prevalent issue across the state. Since the last time that we've met, our statute has been extended that we can investigate and penalize misclassification in all industries, not just construction. So we see it commonly in trucking, home health, beauty services. We were just talking today, tow truck drivers, we see a lot of misclassification in those areas and are able to look into that more robustly. We are regularly receiving misclassification tips via our website and phone calls. Shara has gotten several just this morning. So
a lot of times those lead to a good case for us. A lot of times people are wanting to make a referral anonymously. We were joking just 10 minutes ago that it sounded like the tipster that called in this afternoon was more so angry that his girlfriend went off to be with the business owner and was just wanting to find a way to get back at him. So that he obviously wanted to remain anonymous. So I don't know how far that will lead, but we are still getting tips a lot from our website. But the best tips and the most productive tips that we get are from people in the industry. So as you guys are working and seeing and identifying areas where you think there may be misclassification, please reach out to us. All of our investigators' email addresses and information is available on our map, our coverage area map that's on our website. And we want to dig into these types of cases, want to do as much as we can to kind of eradicate and eliminate this problem. Let's see. There is a new U.S. Department of Labor test coming out next. This goes into effect next week that will determine if someone is an independent contractor or not. I think it's a six-factor test, and it utilizes many of the same factors that we have in the Tennessee Work Comp seven-factor test. So I went to a webinar last week, and one of the kind of good examples that it gave when determining if a business has the exercise of control was that the employer places demands or restrictions on workers that do not allow them to work for others or work when they choose. And we've recently had a case in the Court of Workers' Compensation Claims that it was an expedited hearing order, so it's not a final order yet, but in this case, there was a lady who was working for a property management company, and they renovate rental properties, so it's construction services work. And the court found that because she worked 40 hours a week and her paychecks corroborated her testimony that she never worked fewer than 40 hours a week, it confirmed that she could not have had gainful employment with anyone else while working for the employer. And the court specifically identified that it gives little weight to the fact that the employer did not deduct withholdings from her checks and issued a 1099. The fact that the company did not deduct Social Security or income taxes is not a controlling factor in deciding whether an employer-employee relationship exists. So this is important for what we do, because we are able to use this case law when we're building our own cases and say, look, this is something right here in our state recent where the fact that an employee was being paid 40-hour weeks pointed that she was an employee, which is something that we've kind of been on the fence about a little bit when that's the most that we have to go on. But that is good. It's a good tool to have in our belt. I did want to talk about a specific case that we've had in the past couple of years, and it's kind of a trend that I feel like we have experienced more and more in the type of work that we do, is we'll start out looking at a case that appears to be strictly misclassification, and as we get into it, we are identifying that there was a lot of underreporting on the part of the GC, but there were several legitimate subcontractors that were operating without coverage. So in the specific example that I'm going to talk about today, there was a home builder in the Knoxville area, and the business did somewhere between $13 and $18 million of work in 1 year, in one review period that we were looking at. And they used a variety of people that were probably employees and legitimate subcontractors, but told everyone not to worry about work comp. They would take care of it. There were about 70 alleged subcontractors. And when the builder went to their insurance audit, They did not report any subcontractors. They only reported 8 employees. And subsequent to that, there were multiple injuries from multiple of the subcontractors that ended up going up the ladder and filing a claim against this insurance carrier for coverage. So the insurance carrier reaches out to us. We'd already begun looking at the case because we'd gotten the PBD when there was an injury. The insurance carrier reaches out and is like, what's going on? This business told us they don't utilize subcontractors. So we begin looking into it. We get the 1099s, realize that there's 70 subcontractors. 31 of those we identified as legitimate subcontractors that were just operating without a policy at all. Most of them were operating almost exclusively for this builder without coverage because they had been told, you know, we'll take care of you, everything's okay. The way that our law is written, we have to go after the employer individually, and there isn't a mechanism for us to kind of hold the GC accountable for that. That resulted in penalties being assessed by our program for $725,000 collectively for those 31 subcontractors, most of which obtained their own policy, got into compliance, and agreed to pay the penalties for us in a settlement agreement. We did penalize them individually, but in addition to those legitimate subcontractors, there were about 25 or 30 individuals that were paid during this review period that we identified as probable employees. We didn't have proof of the 7 factors for every single one of those workers, so we did enter into a settlement agreement for the builder to pay a penalty in the amount of $125,000. They paid that off to us in 5 payments, so that they're settled up with us, are allegedly in compliance now. But there is believed to be ongoing civil litigation. I believe that the insurance carrier is suing this business in state trial court because of their fraudulent misrepresentation of not using any subcontractors when they went to audit and the exposure because there were multiple injuries from these subcontractors during that time. They are trying to The insurance carrier is trying to invalidate that policy in state trial court so that the employer will be solely liable for those injuries. But I don't know where the status is on that right now, but that is just one case that resulted in almost $900,000 in penalties for the Bureau. I think Kim Stoner was the primary investigator on this and probably spent 6 months just working these cases from one injury. And I can assure you that there are cases like this all over the state that we just are unaware about because we don't know, you know, where these builders are, that they even exist. And by the grace of God, someone has not been injured yet for it to be put on our radar. So that is kind of the state of where we're at with misclassification is we're looking at a lot of cases. A lot of them are not technically falling under our misclassification penalty statute because there is misclassification aspects of it, but it is a non-compliance case because they don't have insurance at all or are working for general contractors that have a policy that's just not sufficient and are hoping to be covered under that policy. So that's where we're at with misclassification. That's our update. We have had a couple of other significant cases. Our newest investigator, Lakeisha in Memphis, just within the past month, she in April worked to settle a $105,000 misclassification penalty. So that was a significant penalty, and the business is now fully aware of what their responsibilities are as business owner and has agreed to settle with us and remain in compliance. So the next big update I kind of want to talk about and talk about a main issue that we're dealing with in this is our exemption registry. So we worked tirelessly to clean up the exemption registry when we were all meeting together regularly. And that ultimately resulted in it coming to be at the Bureau instead of at the Secretary of State's office, which had many, many roadblocks, many, many bumps in the road. We officially took the registry over in November of 2022. So I think November 7th of 2022 was supposed to be our launch date. We missed that date by about a week, so the registry was completely down for about a week. Then when we were actually able to go live, everything that could possibly go wrong did. It was a technological nightmare, and remained that way for probably, I would say, 6 months. Things are running much more smoothly now, but we quickly identified, we had been informed that, you know, one staff member will be able to handle this. We quickly learned that the phone rings about 100 times a day. So for the one staff member to handle that, as well as processing all of the applications, it was impossible. So Troy was very supportive of us to quickly identify a way to be able to add an additional staff person to the exemption registry. So we do have a better system going on with that now. Things are running more smoothly. There's a way for employers to now upload their IRS FEIN letter for proof to ensure that there is, that is a legitimate business. There's really not a way for us to approve a new application unless we have that IRS letter. If their last four of their EIN and their last four of their social match, the system automatically lets us know, it red flags it for us, this is an issue. So it is built in a way to ensure that we are being as accurate as possible, that people are not kind of slipping into the registry without being a legitimate business. What we have found as we have taken over the registry for a while is that there was and continue to be a lot of applications for non-construction businesses on the registry. We have seen everything from a tire shop to a candy store in Gatlinburg to, and this is one we run into the most, is janitorial and cleaning, that have been on the registry for a decade and paying for their exemption when they just do not meet the qualifications. So we have put on our website the contracting codes list. The main trigger that we kind of helped us identify this was adding the question to the application that says, is your business in the construction industry? And if the applicant clicks no, then it does not let them proceed with the application. So that then in turn results in a phone call for us, and we have to explain that, you know, the exemption registry is just for construction services providers. A big kind of loophole and problem that we have identified and that we have run into consistently in the past year and a half that we have been dealing with the registry is that any non-construction business that subcontracts with a construction business is being asked for an exemption. So we see a lot of pest control people, pressure washers, a lot of non-construction class codes that are, payment is being withheld until they can provide some sort of proof of coverage or an exemption. And those folks, same folks who are just a sole proprietor, non-construction businesses are not having luck getting policies. And what we have identified is that insurance carriers are charging premium for those non-construction subcontractors of a construction service business because the auditor isn't necessarily asking, is this business construction or not? And it has, it is a big time suck for us to try to explain to folks that, you know, you're not eligible for the exemption. You're not required by law to have a policy, but if someone you're subcontracting with wants you to have a policy, that's kind of between you and them. But it is becoming a significant issue that we probably could find a way, a better workaround. But that is our biggest challenge, I would say, at this point, is the non-construction businesses that are being requested a copy of an exemption certificate, and they're just not eligible, especially those that have been on the registry for years and just didn't know that they weren't eligible for it to begin with. So that is, I think, the bulk of my update. And if there's any questions or discussion, I just want to open it up to everybody for comments, questions, et cetera.
What was the name of the case that the expedited hearing, the interlocutory order? I want to go back and read that.
That was Kimberly Hunt versus Steve Kirk and Plaza Insurance.
Okay. Is it recent?
It is recent. It was filed, the expedited hearing order was filed February 7th, 2024.
Okay, that is recent.
2-7.
2-7, yeah. I've got the docket number, Troy, if you want that.
Yeah, I've got a copy of the case.
Docket number is 2023.
I got it right here.
Perfect.
Yeah.
The docket number on that case. Yeah, it's 2023-07-5702, and the expedited hearing was held on February 1st. But it does have a good analysis of the seven factors for this case. So it's a good case to utilize and look back on, especially for wanting something more recent.
Audrey, you made a comment before the last little section. I should have stopped you then. But you made a comment about policy, and I think your words were not being sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expound on what you meant by that?
So what I meant when I said a policy was not sufficient was that the policy did not or does not match the actual exposure, that the payroll or potential payroll was significantly more than what the policy was obtained for. Maybe the policy was obtained for $10,000 to $15,000, and we know in advance that the business is going to be doing at least $80,000 to, you know, $150,000
okay.
in payroll. And so that's kind of a trigger to us to keep a look on it. It doesn't necessarily mean it's going to pan out to anything because, you know, employers always have the opportunity to go to audit, clear things up at that point. But a lot of times we don't see any clearing up at audit, or we don't see any participation at audit at all.
Okay, can I just suggest that the current laws, and I only know what's legal here, there is no sufficient or insufficient policies. Okay? There is none. The policies are very, very clear on what they cover and the potential to have exposures that are not on the application, that are not known at the time, that sort of thing. Now, I will say, I'm very interested about your fraud case because it certainly appears that you got a clear, or Kim has found a clear case of fraud, and that is interesting because the policy absolutely says that they're going to have to cover all 70 of those subcontractors that they didn't know about. And I think we would all agree that that is unfair. But this is not about what's fair or not. It's about what's legal or not. So the carrier, whoever that is, is entitled to that premium, but when they're paying claims over here and it's been hidden from them, that is fascinating. And I don't know that we've got another case that has been even looked at. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I don't know what the end goal of the insurance company is, whether it is to invalidate the policy or whether it is to demand that they pay the actual premium that should have been paid during that time. We'll continue to watch that. It is just a private party lawsuit in state trial court, but we all of our records were requested in an open records request for that lawsuit. That was recently requested, so it is still ongoing. Unfortunately, probably what's going to happen is that it will settle out of court, and we won't have any case law or any update on it whatsoever.
Well, I am not an attorney, but I do sit beside one at the EMAC meeting. The next day, the company absolutely can demand legally that if they can find the exposure and the scope of work, they're absolutely entitled to every penny of that premium and should get it. Now, will they? Probably won't.
They'll probably get a. I think what in reality what will happen is that it will settle for a fraction of what they should have been paid, and it is a lot. I mean that's significantly more than what we assessed in penalties, which was almost $1 million just for 1 year of work from one contractor.
Claudia, thanks for the report. Jim Brown from NFIB, can y'all hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you fine, Jim.
Oh, cool. I saw some numbers on the subpoena power, the positive impact that's occurring from that, which kind of triggered me to nudge Troy and Amanda to kind of get together here, which I'm glad we're doing. What data are you tracking that's showing the misclassification program is working, and what data do you think we should be tracking that will help further?
So as far as the subpoena power, the biggest update in the subpoena power that we had in our most recent kind of legislation overhaul was the ability to assess a penalty just for failure to comply with a subpoena. Previous to that legislation, our option for subpoena enforcement was just to send that to the AG's office and to hope that they continue to we hope that they continue to pursue collecting that information that we're requesting. And most recently, within the past year, a case that we had sent over for subpoena enforcement in 2018 was finally heard, or was finally in court in East Tennessee. So that was about a five-year period that it was taking to try to enforce that subpoena, and the information we had requested was far out of date by that point. But that adding that additional layer of we can assess a penalty for not issuing or for not complying with a subpoena, I think has been helpful in encouraging employers to respond to us. We have been issuing more subpoenas because we have that now. And just this week, we received responses on three of our most recent subpoenas that we sent out. So we are collecting that type of data, how many subpoenas we're sending out, how many are responded to, and we're collecting data on how many employers have gained coverage. I think in 2023, we had almost 4,000 employees that gained coverage, and then also just our penalty assessment and collection numbers, which I've got a little bit of information that I've failed to share on that. As far as collections go, the update on that is that we have a dedicated team now that works exclusively on collection efforts. That was previously done by our admin staff, who are also helping to do the preliminary research on our cases, build our cases, send out our certified mail, do all of the things. Now we do have a dedicated collection unit. We offer recurring credit card payments, which is not something that we've been able to do in the past. We are currently offering an incentive for paying in a lump sum, which has been really productive for us. We've gotten a lot more settlement by offering a small discount for paying all at one time, and that's only if coverage is in place. So far this fiscal year, which started July 1, we have collected $1.5 million. That is about $250,000 more than where we were at this time last year, and $750,000 more than where we were at this time in 2022. So our collection efforts are increasing significantly. The total number of penalties that we're assessing are increasing. Total number of cases that we are handling are increasing, but I don't have all of those numbers in front of me. There's a lot of different data that we're keeping in, unfortunately, in different places in different types of ways, but we are seeing increases in the numbers of cases that we're handling. I think that can be attributed to having more investigators that are more spread out across the state, being able to learn how to do things better in a virtual space, just the rest of the world getting acclimated to virtual life a little bit has been helpful to us. In gathering information from employers and that sort of thing. So, you know, we are tracking a lot of things as best as we can. We can always do better and always are trying to find additional ways, additional data points that would be helpful and interesting to you all, the stakeholders. So if you have any specific things that, you know, you'd like to know some numbers on, we can see if that is something that we keep up with or see if that's something that we should start keeping up with.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think what we're looking for in the business community is, you know, we're some of the stakeholders, and there's some things that we agreed to that we probably wouldn't have 10 years ago because this is a major problem, and I'm glad the program's working better. But what my ask would be of the Bureau would be to pull the numbers together. How many calls, you know what it is, how many calls you're getting, how many cases you've investigated, how many cases did you find fraud, total penalties assigned, and then, you know, looking at compromises you've made with collections, you know, and just putting those numbers out there and then comparing it to the pre-reform, because I think what we'll get asked at some point by the legislature and is, hey, how's that program working over there? And I guess could y'all see my chat questions in the room? Okay, so like my first question was, and the investigators, I'm thrilled that you guys have 10 investigators. But my first question was, you know, how many are they budgeted department bureau employees, or are they paid through the fines and penalties in the program, the misclassification program? You know, you want to know if you're how, and I don't know the answer. I couldn't recall that, so I'd love that answer. But just how the program is functioning. What's the efficacy? What's the return on investment? And then the big question I guess I have is what I see in articles around the country. And Kim Atkins and I talk about this, but you know, how rampant is misclassification in Tennessee in the construction industry? I just read an article about Minnesota. It's 1 in 5 employers are misclassifying. That's, I don't know where they got their data, but I would love for y'all, to work with the department, the commissioner, to see if you can drill down and find out and see how effective this program is in combating that. And what else do we need to do to go after it? I think you have those numbers. You've got great stories. I mean, this is awesome, but just that data and pulling it together, and getting everyone to thinking about labor, business community, insurance, everybody, what can we do better? And what should we not do? And I'm going to just say that what I'm seeing in Minnesota is what I don't want to happen here. There's been a lot of give and take here, but what's going on, you don't have to have a subpoena in Minnesota. You can just go, it's the Wild West, and it's not good for employers that are honest. anyway, so this is some thoughts there. And the other thing that I put in the chat was that we could see Kevin Hale, but we couldn't see Troy Haley. So the great and wonderful Oz, I'm sure, is behind the curtain. So.
Priorities, Jim. Yeah. Come on now. Priorities, brother.
Yeah. And last thing is that, that independent contractor rule, there's a lawsuit in Texas. There was the business community liked the 2021 rule. They do not like this new rule. It's going to cause a lot of confusion. It's really going to impact good operators, in our opinion. And so Associated Builders and Contractors, NFIB, and others are on an amicus brief in that court case. So it's something just to track.
Yeah, there is. I'm attending another webinar next week that's going to talk about some of those challenges. And I think that, you know, there is a big concern, I think, with the last new rule that's kind of just a catch-all that could be anything that is certainly vague as far as any other factor that, you know, they determine might be relevant in determining if someone is an employee or independent contractor.
Yeah, and we know why it's drafted that way, but I mean, we all can agree, here's your tool, be here at this time, you're an employee, but there's other stuff that's in there that's just too much, but that's our opinion.
Well, thank you, and some of that,
Oz.
A lot of...
Jim, I had to turn my camera on so you could see me.
I will do the same, almighty Oz.
All right, any other questions or commentary?
Can I ask a question that it came up 4 years ago, and I think we got an eye roll from Abby on this. So it's a legit question. In the bill or the law that was passed that created the exemption registry stated, and I am paraphrasing here, but it's not that hard to find it in the law, that the fines collected were to be used by the Bureau and not go into the general fund. And I think Abby was like, don't put me on the spot asking me that. But it wasn't exactly that way, and that's not pointing fingers at anybody. But are y'all getting? I mean, are you getting the funds? I mean, you're hiring extra people.
Yes. So the funds for people paying for their exemptions, just the fee to obtain the exemption.
I don't know exactly how the law reads. But I just don't remember. I haven't looked at it in a while, but it seemed like that
so
it was.
Those funds do go directly into the employee misclassification education and enforcement fund. Okay. And Jim, to answer your question from earlier, I believe, and Troy would probably know if I'm wrong, but I do believe everyone on our staff, the compliance staff, we do designate whether we're working on a misclassification case or an uninsured employer's case, and are paid out of each of those respective funds. I don't cut the checks or anything like that, but I don't know that there's been a case where we haven't been paid from one of those two funds as far as our staff. So that is not, we are kind of like the subsequent injury fund in a different pot of money, and it is
Claudia. Claudia, that's great, and I hope I don't get an eye roll from Troy, but that would be also good in a report.
Good.
Sure.
No eye roll was seen here.
Jim, look at me. Eye roll, okay?
Yeah. Oh, I've had your eye rolls.
I got a question, and Claudia, you may not know the answer. The new USDOL six-factor test, mm-hmm. You know, we've got all these different tests. We've got a work comp factor test. We've got that marketplace platform factor test. We've got unemployment has a different test. IRS has a test. What the six-factor test that USDOL has come out with, is that for
wage and hour and overtime?
Okay.
It's for wages and overtime specifically is what that one's for. It's not the IRS test, whatever one they're using, whether they're using the 20 factor or some sort of totality of the circumstances. It is specifically for wage, hour, and overtime.
So, Claudia, we get to still apply the 7-factor test in Tennessee or the 21-factor or 20-factor IRS test, whatever it is. And I know we changed the ABC test on unemployment to 7-factor, I think, T, a couple years ago as well. But how is that applied here now in Tennessee? Has anything changed?
For workers' comp only, we use the 7-factor test that is within our workers' comp statute. It is, I think it's TCA 50-6-102-12D is where our 7-factor test lives. And that the reasoning behind that went several years ago, there was kind of a push to have one centralized way of determining, at least statewide, and workers' comp did get carved out of that because of our historical case law utilizing the 7 factors. So at this point, nothing for us, for our purposes, has changed as far as what factor tests that we use. I always think that almost every test, though, has some sort of factor that talks about control, and everyone has different ideas of what control is. So I like to gather that information to kind of help determine what are some things that we can look at to determine control, and what are some things that work for us, work against us, that sort of thing, in determining whether someone is being controlled by their employer. And one thing that I think was talked about a lot is if it's like a super highly regulated industry, such as I think there was a case in Tennessee one time where it was a Metro Nashville case, and it was a taxi cab driver, and there were a lot of very regulated rules regarding how taxi cab drivers could act and how they had to operate in Metro Nashville. And a court found because of the lack of control that the employer has, it did lend itself to that worker being an independent contractor, because really Metro Nashville government had control over how the employee or the worker conducted themselves. So, you know, that we like to keep an eye on these different factor tests and how they're being utilized, but ours has not changed, and I hope it will not change.
So, yeah, you brought this, just I want clarity here just from you, Troy, especially. Ashley Gold is on here. She's a bright legal mind. So you have this this new 6-factor test that would apply only to Fair Labor Standards Act claims, correct? Overtime, pay only, correct? Okay, so then you have the 7-factor test here in Tennessee that gets applied in workers' comp. If you come across a business owner that is not only misclassifying and you've got a 7-factor test, you have a separate 6-factor test now for unpaid wage claims. Do you come across those, and what do you do when you come across those? Do y'all just call Tia down the hall and say, hey, we got something for you, or how does that work?
We come across those daily, and we usually do make a referral to the caller. We make a referral to to unemployment insurance. We make a referral to them to the U.S. Department of Labor for those folks to handle those questions, because we are – certainly not the subject matter experts there.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other questions or comments?
Good job. Thank you.
Thank you. And some of the information that we do have an annual report coming out at some point. I don't know when. Troy's working on his big letter for that, but some of the information that that we talked about today will be in there, and some additional information and data that it didn't have. It's not exclusively compliance program. It is a bureau-wide report, but that is in the works. So.
Yeah, that's our annual report to the legislature that we're required to do by statute, and that is done June the 30th of every year, and it's got a lot of information in there every year. So I hope folks get it, and we'll take a look at it. We have all of those on our website, too, from prior years, so it will have a lot of good numbers. Kyle works really hard on that, and the rest of the team, too, so it's coming.
All right, well, thank you, everybody, for taking the time to come today, Kevin, in person, and thank you to everybody else for hopping on online. So our goal is to have a couple of these every year going forward. We certainly don't want to go 4 years again without getting together and giving you guys an update. So we hope to do this, you know, at least twice a year going forward, and probably the early spring and late fall to fall on bookends of our conference that we have every year. So if you have any other questions or anything in the meantime, my contact information is on the meeting invite. So reach out to me at any time. I'd be happy to chat or answer any questions you have. And thank y'all.
Thank you.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Y'all my favorite bureaucrats.
Well, we try.
That just means everything, doesn't it?
Nice.
Oh, my
God.
Yeah, whatever.